collusion by the NSO group is to have any credibility at all, the company must disclose whether or not it ever conducted any meaningful human rights due diligence in line with the UN guiding principles on business and human rights, and publish fully the findings of any internal probes it may have undertaken on this issue. The experts also called on the Israeli regime to disclose fully what measures it took to review NSO export transactions in light of its own human rights obligations, adding that it is the duty of states to verify that companies like the NSO group do not sell or transfer technology to or contract with states or entities that are like to use them to violate human rights. The experts added, in recent years, we have repeatedly raised the alarm about the danger the surveillance technology poses to human rights. Once again, we urge the international community to develop a robust regulatory framework to prevent, mitigate, and redress the negative human rights impact of surveillance technology, and pending that, to adopt a moratorium on its sale and transfer. They noted, international human rights law requires all states to adopt robust domestic legal safeguards to protect individuals from unlawful surveillance, invasion of their privacy, or threats to their freedom of expression, assembly, and association. Other advocates for an immediate moratorium on the export, sale, transfer, and use of such surveillance technology include Amnesty International Secretary General Agnes Callamard, an exiled American whistleblower, Edward Snowden, who went even further. Snowden told The Guardian last month, "This is an industry that should not exist. The NSO Group is only one company of many. And if one company smells this bad, what's happening with all the others?"
The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Khamenei, has highlighted the unreliability of foreign providers of COVID vaccines to Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei said foreign providers of the vaccines initially reneged on their promises and refused sales. But things began to change course after Iran successfully managed to produce jabs against the deadly virus at home. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks during a televised speech on Wednesday amid a deadly pandemic wave that has gripped the country. Fortunately, the production of vaccines within the country paved the path for the import of foreign shots as well. Whereas before that, foreign suppliers would renege on their promises despite having received the payments. The leader called on the executive bodies to double their efforts to procure vaccines, whether imported or domestically developed, and made them available to everyone.
We always have to look to the source of problems in the Middle East, and that is usually either the United States or Israel. In this case, I think we can see, or say fairly safely, that the United States is pressuring other countries not to sell vaccines to Iran in order to pressure Iran to re-enter the JCPOA. This is going to be a failed strategy, really failed strategy by the United States, which has never understood people's loyalty to their own government and has tried to bribe or intimidate countries to do the United States' bidding.
Ayatollah Khamenei hailed an initiative by President Ebrahim Raisi to set a one-week deadline for proposals on a comprehensive national response to the current peak of the outbreak. He said the response to the issue should be carefully weighed and any necessary measures adopted and enforced accordingly.
This is another example of that. By preventing other countries from selling vaccines to Iran, U.S. hopes that Iran will agree to concessions to rejoin the JCPOA. This simply isn't going to happen.
Iran is one of the few countries which has been able to produce vaccines against the deadly COVID virus. After a year of intensive research using all internal resources and expertise, Iran joined the handful of countries that produced the coronavirus vaccine. The Ministry of Health later approved the Coviran Barakat vaccine that was jointly developed by Barakat Pharmaceutical Group and Shifa Pharmed Industrial Group. Iran's flagship coronavirus vaccine has hit a production milestone of 5 million doses nearly a month after it was approved for emergency use in the country. Iran has accelerated its inoculation drive against the coronavirus since earlier this month, after the health ministry announced that it can rely on abundant supplies of foreign jabs, as well as regular deliveries of vaccines that are being manufactured inside of Iran. The government says that it is determined to launch the production lot of domestic jabs, but stresses that vaccines must be imported from other countries to save people's lives. Knowledge-based companies, and especially those active in nanotechnology, are playing a major role in helping the vaccine production companies.
This is definitely an example of that, where U.S. sanctions once again have injured innocent people. We remember back in the early part of the millennium when Madeleine Albright, then Secretary of State, was asked if the deaths of 500,000 Iraqi children were worth U.S. sanctions, and she said yes, it was. That's the U.S. attitude. The U.S. government does not care about the suffering of people.
Iran managed to produce vaccines despite being under cruel U.S. sanctions. The sanctions seriously undermined Iran's ability to battle the pandemic.
Iran could certainly have dealt with this pandemic much better than it was able to had the illegal and unjust sanctions not been issued. But Donald Trump issued them, violating international law and U.S. law by doing so when he violated the JCPOA. And the United States once again has blood on its hands. This time, blood of innocent Iranians who would have been able to get the vaccine had the sanctions not existed.
The cruel and illegal sanctions denied Iran access to crucial raw material and necessary equipment.
A controversial photo taken at the Russian embassy in Tehran has angered Iranians. The picture posted online by the Russian embassy this week has drawn widespread criticism and growing calls for an official apology. The controversial photo depicts Russian Ambassador Levan Jagarian and his British counterpart Simon Shercliffe sitting on the porch of the embassy with a third empty chair. It clearly echoes a photo taken in 1943 of Allied leaders Joseph Stalin, Winston Churchill, and U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt at exactly the same location. The Allied leaders met at the Tehran conference to coordinate strategy against Nazi Germany. At the time, Iran was occupied by Russian and British forces despite its neutrality in the Second World War. The 1943 conference at the Russian embassy is seen by many Iranians as a violation of Iran's sovereignty and independence. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif led a chorus of sharp criticism, describing the photo as, quote, extremely inappropriate. On Thursday, Iran's Foreign Ministry summoned the British and Russian envoys over the release of the picture online. The envoys were told at the ministry that the posting was totally unacceptable. The Russian and British diplomats insist that no harm was intended and that the picture was a tribute to the fight against Nazi Germany. Other Iranian officials and people were quick to denounce the photo. Iran's Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf censored the meeting between the Russian and UK ambassadors as, quote, inappropriate and inconsistent with diplomatic protocols, urging the foreign ministry to follow up on the case. Ghalibaf said both ambassadors must swiftly issue an official apology, otherwise firm diplomatic action will be necessary. Foreign Minister-designate Hossein Amir Abdullahian joined the chorus of critics on Thursday. The top diplomat said the picture, quote, showed disregard for diplomatic etiquette and the national pride of the Iranian people. Faced with widespread criticism, the Russian ambassador tweeted that the photo does not have any anti-Iranian context. The envoy said that he is not going to offend the feelings of the friendly Iranian people. The British ambassador retweeted his Russian counterpart's comments. The controversy triggered by the photo is still under the spotlight. Some observers believe an official apology could help end the controversy.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States and Canada, the unprecedented and deadly floods in Western Europe, the soaring temperatures across the world, and severe droughts elsewhere. These are all harbingers of a devastating climate crisis that is to come. The United Nations released its most comprehensive report on climate change yet on Monday. In the document, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, said humans are to blame for the strange and tragic natural catastrophes the world is witnessing. The definite tone marked a contrast from the language used in previous reports, which had said industrial activity was extremely likely to blame. In a statement, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called the report a code red for humanity. The report was published less than 3 months before the United Nations Climate Change Conference 2021, which will be hosted by Scotland. IPCC findings are expected to feature prominently in the discussions.
I think it's too late to keep things as they were. What we have to do is figure out how to moderate the influences of all this. And I don't think it's going to be a pretty sight.
The UN Climate Panel, IPCC, comprises thousands of scientists across 195 countries who compile peer-reviewed research articles about global warming into a report. This year's report was written by over 230 authors who have reviewed some 14,000 research papers. The IPCC report warns that even in the case of the sharpest cuts in emission, the world might not be able to maintain the global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius target set by the Paris Accord, adding that without immediate steep cuts, the average temperatures will soar past 2 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. Moreover, according to the report, even if the world manages to cap global warming at the 1.5 degrees Celsius target, extreme weather conditions will continue to become more common and intense. A rise in sea levels also seems inevitable, as the report says even with the most severe cuts in carbon emissions, the melting of polar ice will elevate sea levels for hundreds or even thousands of years. All is not lost, however, as the IPCC suggests there is still time to prevent the worst-case scenario. The UN panel says the world has about a decade to decrease the rate at which it pumps carbon into the atmosphere before it's too late. Activists and politicians reacted to the findings with alarm.
We're not talking about the root cause itself, the things that is actually fueling these events. We are not holding people in power accountable. We are not talking about the current best available science, what it says, and how the situation looks like now. And we are especially not talking about the gap between what politicians are saying and what they are actually doing.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson called the IPCC report a wake-up call, while U.S. President Joe Biden called for action to fight climate change.
I think a lot of the people who have the power and the money have absolutely no idea how bad things are, because they simply refuse to admit it, and because they're still looking at short term and making more money this quarter and getting elected next time.
Many have so far shrugged off climate warnings and believe the concept of global warming and climate change to be a hoax. But now that there are more signs of climate change than ever before, will there be a universal consensus and will to counter the devastating impact we're exerting on the planet?
A
Iraq and Syria have been struggling with poverty and instability for years. The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 and Washington and its allies' support for opposition groups and al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, as well as crippling economic sanctions, merely added fuel to the fire of instability there and gave birth to Daesh. Since Daesh terrorists emerged in Iraq and Syria, Iran has been providing advisory assistance to the two countries' armies in their fight against the terrorists. On August 7, 2017, Daesh terrorists captured a member of an Iranian advisory support team in Syria near the Tanf border crossing in the southeast of the country. 2 days later, on August 9, Mohsen Hojaji was beheaded by the Takfiri terrorists. The terrorist group published photos and videos of Hojaji's arrest and beheading. The act prompted widespread condemnation of the terrorist group, as well as the admiration of the soldiers who were fighting against it. In a meeting with the family of Hojaji, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, hailed Hojaji as an emblem of sincere and courageous martyrdom and called the Takfiri groups puppets of the United States and Britain. Also, late Iranian commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Qasem Soleimani, slammed the incident as a horrific, inhumane crime that came in the wake of successive blows dealt on several fronts to Takfiri Wahhabi terrorist groups, which are linked to the world's imperialist power. He vowed not to rest until they have taken out every last terrorist from the face of the Muslim world. Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi Commander Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis, who played a decisive role in the full-scale fight against the Daesh terrorists, were assassinated in Baghdad airport in January 2020 in a U.S. drone attack. Two years after the 9/11 incident, the U.S. invaded Iraq and opened a second major front in its so-called War on Terror after invading Afghanistan. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence that took the lives of over a million Iraqis and displaced over 9 million more. Consequently, the chaos that resulted from the U.S. invasion finally gave birth to Daesh terror group in 2014. Elsewhere in Syria, the government has been grappled with foreign-backed militancy since March 2011, that later gave way to the presence of terrorist groups such as Daesh. Furthermore, over the past years, the U.S. has been leading a military coalition conducting airstrikes against purported targets of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group inside Syria without any authorization from the Damascus government. However, numerous reports and official accounts have revealed the U.S. and Israel's involvement in the relocation of Daesh's elements across Syria and shipment of supplies to them. The U.S. has also been blamed for stealing and selling Syrian oil and other resources. Add to this list the crippling sanctions against the Damascus government. The U.S. has targeted Baghdad and Damascus with crippling economic sanctions, which have worsened the socio-economic conditions there.
First of all, let's say Iran is supporting all the freedom fighters in the world and fighting against the terrorists. Even, you know, like we call it, either we call it the Hujaija massacre, brutal killing by ISIS, and then al-Nusra later on. As we know that those movements, let's say, or organizations, according to what Hillary Clinton said, this is, or they were all created by United States.
Washington is directly responsible for the emergence of Daesh and the current instability and poverty that has afflicted the Iraqi and Syrian nations. Ironically, the U.S. punishes countries that are aiding Baghdad and Damascus to fight the Takfiri terrorists with economic sanctions and calls them terrorists. Aren't the real terrorists those who provide assistance for Daesh and worsen the living conditions of people by imposing economic sanctions on their countries?
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website,
www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Raytheon has close ties to the Israeli military and supplies them with missiles, bombs, and other equipment, including the Iron Dome system. Anti-war group said, adding, these weapons have been linked to dozens of attacks that have killed and injured civilians. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jake Johnson, writer. This article is published under the heading, Anti-War Group Blocks Entry to Raytheon Facility to Protest Killing of Civilians. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. A group of anti-war activists blockaded the entrances to a Raytheon facility in Portsmouth, Rhode Island, recently to protest the role the weapons maker plays in the killing of civilians in Yemen, the occupied Palestinian territories, and elsewhere around the world. The demonstration was organized and live-streamed on Facebook by Resist and Abolish the Military-Industrial Complex, RAMINC, and the FANG Collective, a direct action organization based in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. In a statement, the FANG Collective pointed to a 2018 CNN report revealing that Raytheon, the second largest military contractor in the world and the largest producer of guided missiles, manufactured bombs and other munitions that the U.S.-backed, Saudi-led coalition used to kill dozens of women, children, and other civilians in Yemen. The anti-war group said Raytheon also has ties to the Israeli military and supplies them with missiles, bombs, and other equipment, including the Iron Dome system. These weapons have been linked to dozens of attacks that have killed and injured civilians. Two protesters at the Portsmouth facility attached themselves to cars to obstruct the entrances as others chanted, "Shame on Raytheon," and held banners that read, "Raytheon profits from genocide." Police officers soon arrived on the scene and extracted at least one of the protesters from a car, towing it away. "Raytheon profits from the killing of civilians, families, and children in Palestine, Yemen, and elsewhere," one of the demonstrators said, adding, "We can't sit idly by. While Raytheon engineers new and more destructive ways of killing innocent people, Raytheon must be stopped and held accountable." Since 2015, the U.S.-backed, Saudi-led bombing and blockade of Yemen has killed tens of thousands of people and devastated the country, creating what the United Nations calls the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Half the country's people are on the brink of famine. The country has the world's worst cholera outbreak in recorded history, and now Yemen has one of the very worst COVID death rates in the world. It kills one in four people who test positive. American weapons manufacturers like Raytheon have a vested interest in continuing the war and wield an immense amount of power in Washington. It is unlikely the U.S. regime will end the war without a fight. Starting under Obama and continuing under Trump and Biden, the The U.S. have been heavily involved in the war on Yemen, primarily through weapon sales to Saudi Arabia regime and its coalition partners. These weapons are by and large used to intentionally target and kill Yemenis. This bloodthirsty logic has been a driving force behind the war for almost 6 years. Raytheon Technologies, the second largest arms manufacturer in the world, is one major provider of these weapons. It stands out from the rest of its competitors because of its close ties with Saudi Arabia regime, having been the first weapons manufacturer to build a permanent operation there in 1960s, hiring members of the Saudi royal family as consultants and opening a branch of the company in Riyadh in 2017. After the war began in March 2015, Raytheon's stock price went from about $108 to more than $180 in 2019, reflecting billions of dollars in weapon sales to Saudi Arabia. Despite the countless threats connecting Raytheon to Saudi Arabia and its financial interest in the continuing war in Yemen, the company portrays itself as a neutral force, which simply carries out the foreign policy of the U.S. regime and therefore is not responsible for the destruction wrought by its weapons. When Vice President of Business Development and CEO of Raytheon Company International John D. Harris II was asked by the CNBC in a February 2019 interview about the use of Raytheon bombs in Yemen, his response was, "We are an element of U.S. policy. A role is not to make policy. A role is to comply with it." By characterizing itself as an obedient, law-abiding company, Raytheon not only attempts to weasel out of its culpability, but also obfuscates the horrific tragedy playing out in Yemen and other countries where its bombs fall.
In the Gulf of Oman, entering into the Strait of Hormuz and onwards to the Persian Gulf, a war of tankers has been raging on now for several years. Israel and its allies have attacked Iran, sabotaging its tankers, ships, and much more. A lot of back and forth, which you won't hear about in the media. But this week, a lot more attention on the region as an Israeli-managed oil tanker, the Mercer Street, was hit in the Gulf of Oman. Israel, the United States, and Britain were very quick to blame Iran. But do they actually have any proof to back this claim up? Was this incident an Iranian response to recent attacks by Israel, or a false flag meant to malign the Islamic Republic and escalate this situation, this so-called war of tankers, into an all-out conflict? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman are connected by the Strait of Hormuz, which sits right off the coast of Iran. Through this tiny but very vital passage, a large chunk of important cargo is ferried through these waters, making them a prime target not just for piracy and state piracy, but international incidents as well. Around one-fifth of the world's maritime oil supply passes through this vital artery, in addition to one-third of the world's liquefied gas. One of the oil tankers carrying such cargo was the Mercer Street. This Japanese-owned vessel flying a Liberian flag was managed by Israeli-owned Zodiac Maritime, which belongs to a very rich Israeli businessman named Eyal Ofer. News first broke on July 30th that an oil tanker named the Mercer Street had been attacked in the Sea of Oman. Aboard this ship, a British security guard and its Romanian captain were killed after an unmanned aerial vehicle, a UAV or a drone, laden with explosives, hit the ship's bridge, killing them both. It's reported that this was the third drone attack within 24 hours. International condemnation followed very quickly, with several countries immediately rushing to blame Iran, despite the lack of an investigation or any tangible evidence that Iran was behind the attack. The head of Israel's occupation forces, Benny Gantz, threatened military action, saying that Israel was prepared to strike. The new Israeli Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, made another veiled threat, saying that he would exact a price on Iran as Israel pushed for the United Nations to condemn the Islamic Republic. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said that Iran must, quote, face up to the consequences. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that he was confident Iran had carried out the attack, followed by British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, who said that according to British assessments, it was, quote, unquote, highly likely that Iran had attacked the vessel. Well, you see, confident and highly likely are certainly not absolutes. Absent from all this sharp rhetoric and all this condemnation was any actual proof, any actual evidence that Iran was behind the attack. And nevertheless, all these parties stand more than ready to lay the blame at Iran's feet, despite the fact that this drone was not made in Iran, nor was it fired from Iran. Now, Iran has resoundingly denied any involvement with both attacks on the Mercer Street and the other Panama-flagged ship that was supposedly hijacked a few days after. Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson, Saeed Khatibzadeh, called the accusations of the G7 baseless and pointed out the suspicious timing of the attack right on the cusp of President Ibrahim Raisi's inauguration. Zamir Kabulov, Russia's special envoy to Afghanistan, said that Russia did not believe Iran was behind the attack and that the facts needed to be ascertained and established first before a concrete position could be reached on the issue. Nevertheless, despite the lack of any actual evidence, any definitive proof of Iranian involvement, some analysts in the region have speculated that if Iran were indeed behind the incident, what this could actually mean for the so-called war of tankers that has been taking place there in the last years. It is a well-established fact that Israeli warplanes regularly carry out illegal airstrikes on Syrian soil, violating Lebanese airspace in the process. Now, analysts in the region pointed to the fact that just about a week before the two men aboard the Mercer Street were killed, it was reported that two resistance fighters were martyred after Israeli warplanes bombed locations inside Syria. Now, some have speculated that both incidents could be related. Al Alam Television, citing unnamed sources, said that the tanker incident could have been a response, a potential response to the Israeli aggression inside Syria. Following the attack on the Mercer Street, we had a report of a second incident emerging from the Gulf of Oman. Now, the United Kingdom Maritime Trade Operations, the UKMTO, had reported on August 3rd that a Panama flagged ship named the Asphalt Princess had potentially been hijacked. Very obscure details with no concrete evidence, because the mainstream media immediately reported the incident as fact and, of course, blamed Iran despite any actual proof to back this claim up. The UKMTO then stated that mysteriously these alleged hijackers decided to just leave the ship quietly without incident. But apparently this wasn't enough to stop the U.S. State Department from again repeating the allegations, claiming that it believed Iran was behind the attack, even though it was unable to confirm it. Iran's foreign ministry dubbed both incidents, with the Mercer Street and the Asphalt Princess, as suspicious, and again reaffirmed that Iran had absolutely nothing to do with both incidents. Dr. Sayed Mustafa Khokhshesh, senior political analyst and university professor, joins me from Tehran. It's great to have you on, sir. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Professor, I'd like to start out with this this tanker incident involving the Mercer Street and the second alleged hijacked ship. You know, this is not the sole incident that we've seen in the region in the so-called war of tankers, as it's been dubbed, between Iran and Israel. This has been going on for quite some time now. So perhaps could you give us some context why these particular incidents stand out from all the rest?
First of all, after the triple incidents in the Persian Gulf, when the global hawk was shut down by Iran a couple of years ago, followed by a British ship that was captured by Iran and was never let go until a month after they let Iranian Adrian 1 tanker unload its cargo near Syria and left the region, Gibraltar, And then it was only then that Tehran let it go. And the third one, that was the Iranian missile attack on Ain al-Assad Air Base in Iraq. The Americans realized that their military threats would not change calculations of Iranian decision makers.
Right.
And that's one of the two main pillars in the U.S. containment strategy that stands very much on the two pillars of sanctions and posing credible military threat. But of course, it's just a military threat. It's not pursued by action. Otherwise, if they could have beat Iran through military action, they would have done it two decades ago when they invaded Afghanistan and Iraq. And after these triple incidents, Americans realized that their containment strategy doesn't work pretty well anymore. They called for Israel's help to boost their military threat through some kind of action which would be somewhere between peace and war. So the Israelis started attacking Iranian Natanz facility, assassinated Iranian nuclear scientists, and also did a number of other sabotage acts. And they claimed for many of the sabotage acts that never happened, actually, for the purpose of psychological impact on the society and decision makers in Iran and the region. And then that's exactly in the same context that the war, the tankers war, started. But this last one is important because it's a boost. It's an escalation. It shows that Israel is pretty well ready, and it has already started to escalate tensions in waters adjacent to Iran. The Israeli strategy is transferring tensions from occupied territories where Israel is under the threat of Hezbollah, Palestinian groups, and many others, to borders and to waters and lands bordering Iran in the south, in the Persian Gulf and Sea of Oman, as well as in the north, in Armenia, in Azerbaijan, wherever they could deploy their security forces, or they could widen their influence in order to boost and increase threats to Iran, they do that. Therefore, the Israelis are trying to go to phase two of this plan. They are trying to rally international support in order to receive a UN Security Council resolution against Iran to find a pretext to deploy troops as part of a coalition in those waters. One more important point is that they know Mr. Raisi has come already to the office, and his main agenda, including in foreign policy, is increasing foreign trade in order to help Iranian economy. And that means de-escalation of tensions in the region. And that means primarily start talking to the Saudis and see if they are willing to stand in the first category of friends. The Israelis know that if there is a de-escalation of tensions in the region, then all their plans would be called null and void, because they intend to, you know, push the region into tension in order to justify their presence. So they have rushed to preempt Mr. Raisi's de-escalation agenda.
So do you think that they're trying to stop President Raisi's efforts to, you know, counter this idea of keeping Iran maligned and keeping Iran isolated? And with that said, do you see a shift in the attitude from the Axis of Resistance? Because, you know, if it is confirmed to be Iran, this response came very quickly after the incident in Syria, the Israeli strikes which martyred two resistance fighters. We also saw that Hezbollah responded very quickly to Israeli airstrikes in Shebaa Farms. So would you say there's a shift in the attitude regarding Israeli and foreign aggression, that they won't be tolerated passively and there's going to be a tit-for-tat response to each attack?
Definitely. As I said, Mr. Raisi is a much more powerful president than President Rouhani. He would be even stronger than Ahmadinejad. That means that he would be a more powerful and fearful foe and enemy for Israel and for the United States if they intend to continue the same kind of pressures on Iran and defy their nuclear deal undertakings. Then his policies include strategies that have and that would end up in more pressures on the United States, The resistant front will definitely receive much more support under Raisi. But when it comes to other countries in the region that are especially friends to Iran, he would be a much more powerful friend. He would try to expand ties, economic ties with them. So the lines of policies are different if you stand in the first category or the second category. And, you know, the Israelis have perceived that pretty well. That's why they intend to speed up their efforts to go to phase two of their plan that started several years ago when Trump was in office back in 2018-19.
Professor, I'd like to ask you about the second incident which happened in the same week, this so-called hijacking involving the Panama-flagged ship called the Princess Asphalt. This was also blamed on Iran. Could you perhaps walk us through what happened and tell us what's going on here? You wrote on Twitter that the Mossad deployed high-tech equipment in the UAE to stir further tensions in the Persian Gulf and disrupt air and sea navigation. But do we actually know who's behind this? I mean, was it a false flag operation? What's going on?
It was a false flag operation. Everything started when unidentified sources claimed through the British media that some kind of tanker is in trouble, a British tanker is in trouble. Then suddenly they added that Iran might be, you know, involved or some kind of militia supported by Iran. And then they claimed that there is a second, third, and fourth ship. And suddenly they tried to rose tensions to unprecedented levels in those waters, all claims from unnamed sources. And then it was pretty well clear that there is no hijacking because after one day, they claim that everything has been wrapped up. The British Defense Ministry declared that hijacking ended. Well, they could have never, ever evaporated into the air. Where are the hijackers? It's, you know, these waters are surrounded by many military forces and states, for God's sake. Where are those hijackers if there has been a hijacking? And then it was pretty well clear that it was a false flag operation. But this is not going to be the end. It was done in order to push the Israeli-American effort to win a UN Security Council resolution. And it has not ended yet. They are running this propaganda and smear campaign against Iran in order to discredit Tehran and show it as an irresponsible party. As you just mentioned, I wrote in Twitter, you know, from the Nur News that's affiliated to Iran's Supreme National Security Council, that they have deployed equipment in order to, you know, disrupt free air and sea or maritime navigation in the region, to disturb the situation, all in the hope that there would be more tension, escalating tensions, and then Saudi Arabia, UAE, Bahrain, and others would increase tensions against Iran again, and start a coalition with the Israelis.
So, I mean, I know this is a rhetorical question, but what do you think of this hypocrisy that when Israel was attacking dozens of Iranian ships carrying fuel to Venezuela, carrying fuel and aid to Syria to fight the sanctions, you know, there was no outcry. We didn't see any outcry from the British or the Americans about that, and yet they make a giant fuss over one Israeli-owned ship. I mean, what does that say?
Well, when Ned Price quoted his boss's words, Antony Blinken's words, that Iran is endangering free navigation in the Persian Gulf, I reminded them through the Twitter that they have attacked 12 Iranian ships only in the last year. Tankers. They were not alone. They were accompanied by Israelis in some of these cases.
Right.
And how come he never said that when they attacked the Iranian ships and started threatening Iranian supplies to foreign markets? Well, as a matter of fact, this is a very important question. The Americans and Israelis are going along with this strategy, with this plot, and they tried to keep it somewhere between peace and full-fledged war. They intend to pose threats, security threats, sabotage and, you know, assassination. But they also try to keep the situation under control to avoid spiraling of tensions into a full-fledged war. And I do believe that in some phase, sooner or later, they would lose control of the situation, because they may start something, but they are not the one that would continue it. It's Iran, and Iran is not harnessed by the United States. It's not an obedient state. And then they may not be the party to end it. I believe soon they might be fool enough to cross the red line without knowing it, even.
So just as a last question, Professor, do you think that given the situation, the Israelis are going to be more cautious from now on, or feel more emboldened? And what do you think they're pushing for, and how can we expect this to play out?
The Israelis, I believe, are just experiencing their good days. Despite all the problems internally, externally, that they have everywhere, they are pushing the region into more chaos. What happened at the Israeli-Lebanese border, the borders between occupied territories and Lebanon in the last 24 hours, then I believe, an indication. Because as I can see it, the Israelis mean to do the same kind of spearing tension plot that they have in the Persian Gulf and in territories north of Iran, against Lebanon, against Palestine, against Syria. Everywhere they are spearing tensions against not only Iran, but also Iranian allies. And in one of these cases, one of these false flag operations would definitely go wrong, and it would end up in full-fledged war. So the international community, the UN Security Council, should act and think wisely to harness the Israelis if they do not want to see the region in fight.
So if the Americans and the British and the international community are in uproar about an Israeli tanker being hit, why did they say nothing when Israel targets dozens of Iranian ships, causing much more damage? Stay tuned to find out. We'll be right back after this short break. So while this recent incident with the Mercer Street has been amplified and blown up in order to paint Iran as a villain, Iranian ships have been attacked by Israel for years. But did the media tell you about all those incidents? Now, Iran itself is under crippling sanctions, but despite this, it has never denied help to its allies and helps them when it is itself in need. Iran supports the resistance in Lebanon, Palestine, Iraq, and has sent countless amounts of aid, fuel, and support to Syria and Venezuela, also targeted by U.S. sanctions. And this really underscores the level of support and solidarity within the axis of resistance. The United States and the European Union targeted Iran and its allies with sanctions in order to force regime change and stop their resistance to imperialism and colonization. And because Iran and its allies have tried to find ways around these sanctions, they've been punished and attacked for this. In July 2019, the British just went ahead and decided to hold up an Iranian oil tanker in the Strait of Gibraltar. The ship was released only after Iran threatened to halt a British tanker in response in the Strait of Hormuz. Then a few months later, in October 2019, an Iranian oil tanker was mysteriously attacked off the Saudi coast. And to give you more examples in similar acts of piracy, both Presidents Donald Trump and Joe Biden have stolen Iranian oil headed to help the people of Venezuela and sold it off for millions of dollars. In March 2021, the Wall Street Journal reported that Israel had in fact targeted dozens of Iranian ships through various acts of sabotage. We also know that Israel has murdered numerous Iranian nuclear scientists as recently as late 2020. Israel has attacked Iran's nuclear facilities and also bombed Syria regularly, almost on a weekly basis. And despite all of this, do you know about any of these events? Have you ever heard any outrage from the United States or the United Kingdom in regards to Israel's aggression towards Syria or Iran? Not a peep. Has anyone tried to condemn them at the United Nations for this? Nothing, not a word. And yet, in the United States, in the West, not just the governments, but also the mainstream media, they constantly attack Iran and accuse it of destabilizing the region. They constantly accuse it of piracy and even smuggling. Iran underscores its right to defend itself and its waters. However, is it possible that this latest attack is a false flag? And if so, it would not be the first time. It wouldn't be the first time that the West has made up similar incidents in order to escalate confrontations and to start wars. False flag operations have always been used by the West in order to blame other countries and start wars. In 1962, under Operation Northwoods, the United States government wanted to commit acts of terrorism against its own citizens, including bombings and hijackings, but to make it look like Cuba was responsible so it could justify a war with the Caribbean nation. In 1954, the Mossad, Israel's intelligence service, also carried out false flag operations known as the Levant Affair, which sought to cause instability inside of Egypt in order to maintain a presence of British troops in the Suez Canal. History is littered with examples of this. They have a very, very long history and habit of using false flag operations in order to pursue their military objectives and their foreign policy objectives, even if it means war. And this is not just extremely concerning, but extremely important, because we need to understand the history in order to understand the present. And so given this long covert history of British, American, Israeli intelligence in executing false flag operations, we can begin to understand that not everything is exactly as it seems. So when you hear on the news that Iran is behind an attack in the Gulf of Oman, and the media immediately reports it with absolute certainty and conviction, even though there's no proof or investigation, you really have to exercise some caution and be realistic here. Just because the Western governments and their media jump to blame Iran or anyone else for something doesn't necessarily make it true. You must be very wary of what is reported in the Western press because of their practices and because their duty is not to the truth, but to the pockets of the weapons industry. Nevertheless, let us assume for a moment that what they're saying is true. Let's say that they're really telling the truth and that this was a move by the resistance. Then it's important to note the timing. Analysts in the region view it as a swift response to the Israeli aggression in Syria just a week before. And in the past days, when Israeli planes bombed Lebanon, bombing a patch of open land, Hezbollah was quick to respond with a barrage of rockets of its own, also on a patch of open land, in order not to escalate, but to keep them in check, as they said. Now, veteran war correspondent and political analyst Elijah Manier explained in a recent article the significance of this recent development, that if this attack really was from the resistance front, it is significant not just in timing, but also because it takes the Israelis out of their comfort zone and into the Gulf of Oman, which is uncharted territory for them compared to usual. This tit-for-tat response indicates two things: that the resistance front is only responding defensively, it is not the aggressor, and furthermore, that the resistance front will not let Israeli or foreign aggression go unanswered, and it will respond quickly. And the point that I would raise here is that, again, if you're going to say that all of this is true and you're going to go and blame Iran and say it must be held accountable, then what of the countless Israeli attacks on Iranian ships? How can you hold Iran accountable but not Israel when Israel's attacks are far more numerous, on far more occasions, in far more manners, and cause way more damage? Why isn't anyone in Britain or the U.S. calling to hold Israel to account for these aggressions? The West doesn't really care about international law or rules-based order or any of these things. This is about bullying and coercing Iran and its allies because they won't bend the knee to Western hegemony. It's about bullying and coercing them for the crime of trying to feed their people and defend themselves from foreign aggression and by circumventing illegal unilateral sanctions. Because if it really were about the crime, they will be seeking to hold Israel accountable for the same crimes, and yet they don't. It's about reinforcing imperialism, and anyone who can't see this isn't willing to see the truth. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Louisiana has seen the most COVID-19 cases per 100,000 residents in recent days, compared to every other state in the U.S., and only 38% of the population are fully vaccinated, according to data from the New York Times. Staff shortages are also an issue across the state, with over 6,000 open nursing positions. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Louisiana and Mississippi Health Systems on Brink of Collapse as Low Vaccinated Regions Suffer. Stay tuned for more. Though coronavirus outbreaks largely driven by the ultra-contagious Delta variant are now even occurring in U.S. counties where over half the population is vaccinated against COVID-19, recently the hospitals in two states with among the nation's lowest vaccination rates, including Louisiana and Mississippi, were dangerously overwhelmed. Louisiana has seen the most COVID-19 cases per 100,000 residents in the last 7 days compared to every other state in the U.S., and only 38% of the people are fully vaccinated, according to data from the New York Times. Mississippi has the third most recent cases in ranking and only has a vaccination rate of 35%. Both states have seen major increases in hospitalizations over the past 2 weeks. Since the U.S. inoculation effort began, public health experts, including the nation's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, have repeatedly emphasized that the authorized vaccines not only lower the risk of getting COVID-19, but also decrease the chances of hospitalization or death for vaccinated individuals who experience a breakthrough infection. That position was backed up by a Times analysis involving 40 states and Washington, D.C., published earlier this week, though. The newspaper noted that the data generally spanned the period from the start of the vaccination campaign until mid-June or July, before the Delta variant became predominant in the United States. The Times found that fully vaccinated people have made up as few as 0.1% of and as many as 5% of those hospitalized with the virus in those states, and as few as 0.2% and as many as 6% of those who have died. In Louisiana, vaccinated people were 1% of all COVID-19 hospitalizations and 1.4% of deaths. In Mississippi, those figures were 0.4% and 0.6%, respectively. Florida, one of the other states experiencing a large surge in infections and with a vaccination rate of 50%, was among the states not included in the analysis. Currently, about 90% of coronavirus patients in Louisiana hospitals are not fully vaccinated, The Guardian reported recently, citing the state's Department of Health. The report continued, while fear of the Delta variant has led to some increase in vaccinations in the state, Louisiana's healthcare system is straining to keep up with the rate of new infections. Hospitals in southwest Louisiana have diverted ambulances to Texas to find a facility with the capacity to take care of patients. Southwest Louisiana, which was devastated by Hurricane Laura last year, has the lowest vaccination rate in the state. There are fewer intensive care unit beds in the region than there were the day after Hurricane Laura came ashore as a Category 4 storm, said Dr. Lacey Cavana, the regional medical director for Region 5. It's incredible that we had more capacity the day after Hurricane Laura, with hospitals evacuating, with no power and no water, than what we have right now, she said. The influx of sick COVID-19 residents is overwhelming ambulances too, which are responding to significantly more calls, said Dr. Chuck Burnell, the chief medical officer for Addison Ambulance. Delta is very bad, he said. It's put a strain on every facet of the healthcare system. Staff shortages are also an issue across the state, with over 6,000 open nursing positions.